Hi, listeners. It's Dr. Risa E. Lewis dropping in to thank you. Thanks to all of you for joining and supporting us in our book journey. I'm so glad to share that Microskills was selected as a next Big Idea Club must read for April 2024. Microskills, small actions, big impact. Order now wherever you buy your books.
There was a point where I was feeling really physically bad and put on weight. And so I decided to go with that whole, like, what are these superfoods, quote unquote superfoods? And for 2 or 3 weeks, I ate really well. And I'd ask Twitter, what superfoods do you recommend? And I took that list and I ate only those foods, grains, berries, dried fruits, nuts, avocados, things like that. And after the first week, I felt like a new person. I felt so physically good. I felt energetic. And I realized that what I was eating was 100% how I felt.
This is the Visible Voices podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Risa Lewis. In today's episode, I am so glad to bring you my conversation with Jamie Schler. Jamie is an award-winning writer specializing in food and culture. She's the host of the foodish podcast, Stir Crazy, where, quote, I ask the questions no one else asks. She's an American in France. She's a hotel owner, a jam maker, a French cuisinophile, love that word, and the author of 2 books, Orange Appeal and Isolation Baking. Jamie grew up in Florida, and as she quotes, it was along the Atlantic Ocean, surrounded by the world-famous Indian River citrus groves. Hence, there was a huge exposure and injection of oranges. Now, when we get to the episode, we are talking about, Jamie's personal and professional journey, how she came to be in France, and why speaking about food and drink, making food and drink, and sharing meals really just is everything. I love your infusion of politics with your posts. You jumped across the pond. I did that on purpose. Uh-huh. Politics, posts, pond. And you arrived in Paris. Take it from there.
Precipitously.
Beautiful.
I met up with a friend and we kind of bummed around. And basically for the next 2 years, I remember that you could still pretty cheaply buy a one-way ticket. And it was about 1,400 francs. So when I was down to 1,400 francs, I would fly home and I would work to earn the money to go back. So the first time I went back to do some research for a book my former boss was doing. And the other times I went down to Florida and my father had taken ill. My father was very sick and dying at that point. So I would go down, I would temp and I would help with my dad. And then I would go back to Paris, and 2 months later, I would be down to the price of a one-way ticket back home, and I would repeat. Until 2 years later, I met someone and married him and stayed.
Your now life is as hotel owner and jam maker, podcaster, baker, cookbook author.
I don't sleep a lot.
You don't sleep a lot. A lot of people are curious about your current life. What's it like to run a hotel?
It's a lot more work than people think from the outside. The first thing is that it's a hotel. It's 27 rooms. I think a lot of people, when they see what I post on social media, think that I run a bed and breakfast. This is a hotel with 27 rooms, max capacity, 55 people. And with a very 6-7 month long high season. And so we live on the premises. We have an apartment in the hotel and we are either working or basically on call 24/7.
Part of the purchase of the hotel was a commitment to a legacy of jam making.
Yes. I've been a passionate baker for several years. The task just fell to me. And I'm glad it did. I'd never made jam before. I learned in 2 weeks by watching the former owner, because we're the fourth owners of the hotel, which was created in the 1960s. And the tradition of making all the jams that are served for breakfast on the premises started with the first owner. And so it just passed down the line. And so I learned in 2 weeks how to make large batches of jam. So we're talking 15 to 20 jars at a time, 6 kilos of fruit. And so I just then took off, trial and error. And to keep it from becoming too much of a task, I started, also out of necessity, I started to just create new flavors and test flavors and test using spices and herbs and liquors and mixing different fruits. And I talk a lot to our clients because a lot of people who stay at the hotel are jam makers, and I love talking to them and getting their tips. And they've told me their flavors they've created that I start to make then. And it's something that I really love. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, but it's one of my favorite parts about owning and running a hotel. It is my favorite part, except for the friends I've made along the way of, you know, friends of clients. But
yeah, the pictures that you've posted of the jam making, both in the pot as well as the finished product nicely aligned mm-hmm. on a shelf, really caught my eye. And I want to get maybe one or two specifics. What is one flavor that just surprised you? You started because of a client or hotel guest? And what is one big error in jam making that you can share as a tip for listeners?
Well, two surprises, actually. I mean, I've developed a lot of flavors, but one was we were shutting the hotel for vacation because we make fruit salad, fresh fruit salad every morning for breakfast. The day we closed for vacation, I had like 8 pink grapefruits and 20 kiwis left that hadn't been used yet. And I said, oop, you're going into jam. And so I did pink grapefruit and kiwi. And I cooked it and I jarred it. And I, as I was jarring it, I tasted it. And I thought, oh, this is just terrible. This is so bitter. The grapefruit just really came out. It was so bitter. But since I never throw anything out, I jarred and sealed all of them and put them in the dining room in a cabinet in the back. And 6 months later, I don't know if I just came upon them or my employee came upon them. And I thought, well, you know, why don't we just open one and see what it tastes like? And I opened it and the flavors, the bitterness had completely moved to the back and the fruitiness of the kiwis had come forward. So there was just like an after, a little zing of bitterness at the back of your mouth at the end. And it was really, really good. That I learned because it happened with another flavor where I had to put it away for like 6 months, and then the flavor just evolved. I can't even say developed. It just evolved into something else. And that was a big lesson for me. And the other was people around me bring me green tomatoes, which is green tomato jam is a very old French traditional jam. And it's been a tradition of the hotel since the first owner. And so I make green tomato jam with tomatoes people bring me. And 1 year I had so many green tomatoes that by the end I had probably the equivalent of 6 kilos of tomatoes that had ripened and turned red. So I decided to make red tomato jam and I did it with vanilla bean. Same thing. I took it out, tasted it. It was horrible. It was just horrible. I put it away and a little while later we took it out. And we served our local cheese in this area, in this region, is goat. And we serve fresh goat cheese for breakfast. And I don't know what made me think of doing this, but I put a spoonful of red tomato jam on a piece of goat cheese and tasted it. And it was out of this world. Eating it like jam, like sweet jam on bread, was horrible. But on the goat cheese, it was just magnificent. So it's just weird accidents.
Yeah. The listeners are now getting a sense of you, your creativity, your passion, and your true hard work towards this art, the art that you've put out in the world. You put together during COVID a book, a cookbook called Isolation Baking. And now mm-hmm. you actually have a Substack for which you do quite a bit of research. So first, tell us about Isolation Baking and any other writings, and then we'll get to your research.
Well, I had already had published in 2017, traditionally published cookbook called Orange Appeal. And I had been putting together a couple of projects for other cookbooks. And my husband had worked in professional medical publishing for many, many, many years. And the physical creation of a book or a magazine is something that is passionate to him. He loves the layout, the font, the colors, the photos. And he'd been bugging me for a while to let him to work together and do an e-cookbook. This came about actually another kind of weird accident, because all of us were spending so much time on social media. And primarily at that time, I was on Twitter. And when COVID happened and we went into isolation, I accidentally came across a debate between a couple of people about the best banana bread recipe. And I said, mine is the best. And so I decided to put the recipe on Twitter, which I'd never done before. And so I did a thread of the entire recipe. And I had such an incredible response. So many people made that banana bread. And in particular, this gentleman who, an adorable guy, he's a trucker, one of these, you know, stereotypical, big, huge, burly, bearded trucker out west somewhere. And he sent me a message saying, I have never, ever baked anything in my entire life. And I decided to bake your banana bread for my mother. And now I make it every week for her. And that kind of inspired me. So I thought, well, here we are in COVID. Nobody knows what to do. People are stockpiling, I don't want to use the word hoarding, but stockpiling things like flour and yeast, and they don't know what to do with it. So why don't I start posting recipes? Because I had such a success with that one. I started posting recipes. People went so crazy for it because nobody else was doing this. I ended up posting 2 recipes a day. Luckily, I had my old blog. I had a big stockpile of recipes. And people were doing them and making them. And people were sending me messages saying, you know, between the insanity that was the Trump presidency and COVID, people were going insane. And the fact that they felt like this was a community baking project, because everybody was putting posts, you know, photos on Twitter of the finished products. And they could comment on each other's stuff and they could ask questions about the baking process. People were just thrilled that there was this community baking project going on to distract them from everything else. And after I had done, put about, I don't know, 100, 130 recipes up, I let my husband turn it into an e-cookbook.
I'm Dr. Risa E. Lewis, dropping in to tell you about a book that Dr. Adair Landry and I wrote. It's called Microskills: Small Actions, Big Impact. It's a business self-help book being published in April of 2024 by HarperCollins. We believe every future goal, complicated task, and healthy habit can be broken down into simple, measurable, and tiny skills that you can practice and then excel by removing obstacles, overcoming assumptions, and maximizing your potential at work and in life. You can pre-order it now. Go to bookshop.org, amazon.com, or wherever you buy your books. Yesterday, I had the occasion to bake with you. We did a virtual baking class, and it was so much fun. And you and I have covered a few of these topics in the past, but yesterday we did a little bit of a deep dive into your research for your posts. And one interesting story I think it's worth sharing is your research in the history of chocolate. And I'm wondering if you can share that.
Well, what I do is I've been reading a lot about the history of French cuisine, because as an American, I know that a lot of Americans have a lot of misconceptions about what French cuisine is and what French food is. And I know that as a food writer, those misconceptions are being perpetuated in food magazines and in cookbooks for an Anglophone American audience. I did a couple of histories of recipes for a couple of publications, Fine Cooking, The Art of Eating, of individual dishes. Because when you start to go into individual dishes or individual ingredients in the history, specifically in France, you start to piece together a history of that cuisine as a whole. So I attack it as one recipe, one dish, one pastry, or one ingredient at a time. And I have discovered a couple of places online that have a lot of really ancient cookbooks, old cookbooks online, so I can go in and actually read these books. But what happened with chocolate was, which ended up being the three posts, it was so involved, and understand that that chocolate didn't come to France until the 15 or 1600s. It was pretty, it's pretty recent comparatively. And so I discovered this site and I started to go in and look at old cookbooks to see when cookbooks started, authors started putting recipes with chocolate in it. And what I came upon was a lot of books from the 16th, 17th, and then 18th centuries, studies of chocolate and religious writings about chocolate and health books which talked about chocolate. Because for a very long time, chocolate was a pleasure for the wealthy, but it was also medicinal, pharmaceutical, and there were religious arguments about it. And so I kind of ended up being sucked into these old, you know, centuries old books written about chocolate and just reading about it. And it was just, it just was fascinating. And I couldn't stop. It took me ages to get these posts out because I just couldn't stop reading these books about the religious argument. Is chocolate a food? Is it a drink? Can it be eaten for Lent or not? Is it medicinal? Is it pleasurable? Is it sinful? And then the medicinal uses were, I mean, for a long time, it was treated as a drug with everything that goes into it because they were doing chocolate with vanilla, with chili, with like a whole slew of different spices. And each one of those spices was added because it in turn had a medicinal virtue. These topics are just so fascinating for me. And I keep coming across dishes that seem so common and banal, like ratatouille, for example. And when you start to research, go back in time and read these, not just cookbooks, but articles and books mentioning these particular dishes, you just come across the craziest stuff that you would never imagine is behind a dish that today has become so common.
Right. I want to go back to chocolate as sinful.
Well, primarily there was, and I should have looked up his name, there was, I believe he was Austrian, a theologian, but he was convinced that chocolate was responsible, and I can't remember, this was in the 1600s, I think. He was convinced that chocolate was responsible for a spate of pregnancies in convents. Nuns were falling pregnant and debauchery in monasteries. And so he waged this campaign that kind of grew to a European level and arrived at to the Pope about how the Pope had to ban chocolate as the devil's drink in order to save the religion and save the nuns and save the monks. And he was not successful. Let's just say he was not successful. No one wanted to touch that. And the Pope said, no, it's okay. Everything's good.
I enjoyed that story so much. Yesterday in our baking, we did talk a bit about citrus and you shared with the listeners that your first book focused on orange. And I had outed myself that orange is not my favorite citrus, that I'm a huge lime and lemon fan. What inspired the focus on a cookbook on oranges?
Well, I was looking with my agent. My agent kind of pushed me at some point to write a cookbook proposal. And I started to look around to see what I wanted to do. And, you know, French cuisine was always my passion, but I didn't think that a publishing house would want, at that point, another French cookbook. So I put that aside. And so I looked around, and it happened to be 2015, 2016, and citrus. There were a lot of cookbooks that came out, not a lot, but a good number of citrus cookbooks and articles on citrus came out and were published. And I'm a Florida girl. I grew up in Indian River. Indian River, Florida, is famous for its oranges and grapefruits, world famous. So citrus has always been a passion for me from when I was a kid, and we would just like, you know, buy them directly from the groves, buy the big paper bag full, so there's brown grocery bags full of them. And so I started to look into it, and I realized that people automatically, when they thought about baking or cooking, would go to lemon. And I was very confused about why no one had thought to write a book dedicated just to the orange, because I find the orange so the most versatile of all the citrus fruits. And so I put together the proposal and I got a publisher. And so I wrote this cookbook. And I will tell you that most people think about using citrus, primarily citrus, but primarily oranges in desserts. But half my recipes are savory, soups, salads, dishes, stews, chicken, meat, and vegetables with orange in it. And I had about 15 or 20 recipe testers all over the United States, all over the world. And we were all constantly blown away by what oranges did to savory dishes. That was a surprise. So if you don't like oranges and sweet, try them in savory. You'll be surprised.
I like that. I'm open to it. I also don't want to feel neglectful of the pink grapefruit. I'm a huge fan of pink grapefruit.
Mm-hmm. See, I've not, my husband made a tagine once with pink grapefruit in it. In fact, I upped that recipe with orange and it's in my book, but he originally did it with just pink grapefruit, which I found very unusual, but it worked.
Jamie, your voice. When did you realize you had a voice and when did you start using your voice?
When I started writing about food. When I was in college, I took a creative writing class and I locked horns with a teacher. I felt like it was the first time I had really loved doing anything, and that was writing. But I didn't really feel confident about it. But when I started writing about food, I started my blog in 2008, and I started freelancing professionally in 2010. And I really knew that I was good. And I know that when I look back at my stuff, I've evolved. I mean, we all learn our craft as we go, and I write much better than I did back then. But I knew that with the focus of food, I had a lot of stuff to say. And I felt I loved writing about food, and I felt like I was good at it. And I think with my Substack, well, I'm working on a couple of projects, a jam cookbook, which has been in the works for years, but writing about French food and its history, and I've started working on the memoir of my time in the hotel.
That's a perfect segue to me asking about your legacy.
My legacy. Well, I will say I have two sons who I should count as my legacy because I'm always astounded at how brilliant and successful and funny and generous they are. And I take that as my legacy, our legacy, that we raised these two really freakily amazing guys. But on the other hand, I am at that point in my life where I feel like I need to find what my legacy is, and I haven't found it yet. And I think I'm getting a little bit nervous that I won't have the time to develop that legacy, but I know what has to do with the books I'm writing. I think that because when you think about what legacy are you leaving, it means you have had to have done something big enough that it makes a big splash, that it has an effect on other people. And I think that's why I'm working on these book projects, because I think that's the way that I can have a legacy. It's got to be through that. That's the channel that I think I need to take. But I'm not there yet.
We spoke of your voice, finding your voice. And I mentioned in reading your bio, your line item of podcaster, Stir Crazy Podcast. And when I was getting to know you, I binge listened to all of your episodes. And I'm wondering where you are with your podcast and what listeners can expect coming from that angle.
Okay, so I started Stir Crazy during COVID, and I released, how many have I released? 5, 6, 7, I can't remember. And I will talk about it a little bit more, but where I am now is that I have four that I taped solo with my producer that he never edited and got out. And then he couldn't do the, he couldn't produce me anymore. He was too busy with other projects. And so I still have four episodes that I've taped with extraordinary guests. And I recently this year have joined with a, for the moment, secret co-host. And we now have a big podcast production company who will be producing us. And we are in the middle of taping episodes in order to have a stock of them so we can start releasing them once we're ready, releasing them once a week. And the concept basically is, as a food person, as a food writer, there are a gazillion food podcasts that exist. But primarily, as far as I see it, almost all of the food podcasts, their guests are always food professionals, whether they're cooks, chefs, food writers, cookbook authors, producers, farmers, artists, food artisans. They're always in the food profession of some sort. And I wanted to have a kind of food podcast where I talk about food, primarily food, with people who are not in the food business, people who are well known in their own field. They're political journalists or they're politicians, they're act, cinema, you know, movie actors or musicians. Because people who are not food professionals still have so many fascinating stories about food that tells so much, not only about food, but tells about them. And as I'm doing it, I'm realizing that the way people talk about food, and I try and bake or cook something with them at the beginning of each podcast, and people don't understand how personal food is and how much they reveal about themselves in talking about food. And, you know, their own food history and experiences and their approach to cooking and baking. And I get these, you know, well-known guests in these other fields and talk about food. And it really allows the public who know these people as, you know, on the cinema screen or on TV or in the newspaper, it allows them to get to know this person personally, because talking about food reveals so much about a person. And I've had so much fun doing it. And I've been surprised with the results, that the way my guests have opened up and how they, plus how they cook and bake with me, which is wild. Because when you look at even the ones that have been out already are live, you'll see that each of my guests approaches the recipe completely differently. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah. I think it is true that you learn a lot about someone in cooking, in sharing meals, in talking about food. Yes. I've witnessed it through your episodes, but I've even witnessed it personally if I share a meal with someone, and more that is exposed when you're in someone's home and eating, sometimes preparing the meal together than sitting and eating, much more gets revealed than meeting someone out at a restaurant. And so what you just shared resonates a lot with me. I would be remiss if I didn't speak with you about food as medicine. The American College of Lifestyle Medicine has six pillars: evidence-based, science-supported to help reverse, treat, and prevent chronic diseases. And one of the major pillars is food as medicine. You made a reference to the medicinal history of chocolate, and I'm wondering the extent to which food as medicine plays a role in your thoughts and in your preparation and in what you're putting out in the world.
I only actually think about it in relationship to myself. And I'll tell you why, in a bad way, in fact, because before we bought the hotel, my husband, who's been cooking since he's been 6 years old, we cooked and baked all the time. We had, you know, the hotel is so time consuming and so psychologically consuming. It consumes your brain, it consumes your body, it's, you know, mealtime. You just really don't have the energy or the focus to cook a meal, which is surprising because I wrote an entire cookbook during high season of 2016 and 2017. So I had that focus and I was able to do it. And when I do decide to cook or something, after I do it, I realize, well, that was pretty easy. But before you'd get to that point, you just can't even imagine going out, buying ingredients, coming home and cooking a healthy meal. So our diet has been really bad. And we go out a lot, which means being in France, you end up eating a lot of meat-heavy meals. And at home, we eat a lot of easy, you know, a lot of pasta, a lot of cheese and bread, very French. And I think about it because there was a point where I was feeling really physically bad and put on weight. And so I decided to go with that whole, like, what are these superfoods, quote unquote superfoods? And for 2 or 3 weeks, I ate really well. And I'd ask Twitter, what superfoods do you recommend? And I took that list and I ate only those foods, grains, berries, dried fruits and nuts, avocados, things like that. And after the first week, I felt like a new person. I felt so physically good. I felt energetic. And I realized that what I was eating was 100% how I felt. I was eating poorly. I felt poorly. I was eating well. I felt well. But unfortunately, it was tough with, you know, the hotel high season to keep that up. And so I'm back at my old, you know, my old bad eating habits. So I am 100% convinced that that is something that I should really, you know, everyone should, as far as they're able to do it and able to afford it, eat, you know, well, I guess like we used to eat before we bought the hotel.
For listeners that want to follow you, watch your progress, buy your books, where can they find you?
All you have to do is remember Life's a Feast. So my old blog is Life's a Feast. It's still live, but I don't add to it anymore. My Substack is Life's a Feast by Jamie Schlur. Handles on Twitter and Threads and Blue Sky and Instagram is Life's a Feast. So you can either find me at Jamie Schlur or at Life's a Feast. Definitely check out my Substack because I'm having such great fun with it. And the food part is free. So you'll get the food history and you'll get very good recipes of traditional French food and pastries and breads. And if you'd like to become a paid supporter, I am slowly putting for paid subscribers to my Substack. I'm putting up segments of my memoir that I'm writing about the hotel. First draft, unedited, raw stuff, but trying to put it out there to kind of, you know, inspire me to keep writing and hopefully getting feedback from my subscribers.
Jamie Schlur, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. This was wonderful. I'm very flattered and honored actually to be on your podcast because your podcast is just amazing.
The Risa Wrap-Up. Special thanks to Jamie Schlur for joining me in conversation. And I am so glad that thanks to social media, Jamie and I are friends. And gosh, do I learn a lot from her posts, her tweets, her Substack, her podcast, and more. 3 take-home points for you, audience. First of all, deliberate rest. Sharing a meal, cooking together, and the conversations that happen over food and drink. That's, believe it or not, deliberate rest. And deliberate rest is good for you. It's good for us. Because then, when you deliberately rest, you can deliberately practice better. I first learned about this whole concept in a book by Alex Sujung King Pang called Rest, Why You Get More Done When You Work Less. Number 2, working with your hands. So a gifted psychiatrist and premier hand surgeon, a wife-husband team, Carrie and Alton Barron, they wrote a book. The name of that book is The Creativity Cure, How to Build Happiness with Your Own Two Hands. And when I read this book, I was blown away. It explains why some people really like folding laundry. Some people like doing the dishes. Some people garden. Some people knit. This concept of working with your hands and the hand-brain-motor connection, it does something. It's good for us. It's healthy. Hence, cooking, making food, and doing that together. Finally, you can't just spontaneously get pregnant by eating or drinking chocolate. Also, I want you to remember the power of citrus. Now, in my case, my preference is limes, lemons, and pink grapefruit. In Jamie's case, that means oranges. And in fact, she wrote an award-winning book about oranges. That's all I have for you this week, audience. See you next time. The Visible Voices podcast amplifies voices both known and unknown, discussing topics of healthcare, equity, and current trends. We are a production of the People's Media Network. Our team includes Dr. Giuliano DePorto and me, Dr. Risa E. Lewis. Please find me on social media at Risa E. Lewis and through the website, thevisiblevoicespodcast.com. If you like the podcast, please rate and review us. Share the podcast with a friend today. Thank you so much for listening, and as always, to be continued.
Do you know there's research that women that attend women conferences are more likely to have a promotion or a raise in the next year? Imagine if you could also attend a retreat in California and enjoy some sunshine and beach time. That's what we've put together for you April 5th through 7th in Huntington Beach, California. Visit peoplealwayshcc.com/revitalize-retreat to learn more.